What I want to talk about tonight is the fact that we will never have gender equality in our society unless we confront the unique and, I would say, inappropriately unique status that is given to the Bible by American evangelical Christianity.
Why is it today that we have such an influence of that particular brand of religion in our society, do you think? What is the appeal? Why does it exist?
Evangelical religion is particularly appealing. I wouldn't say, first of all, that it is more appealing now than it has been in the past. But it is persistent in our society. What's unique about American Christianity is how incredibly centered it is on the Bible itself. So I would say, and I'm not alone in saying this, that in American Christianity, the Bible takes on the status that an idol might have taken on in a preliterate society. It's treated as if it were perfect and complete. It's essentially given the attributes of divinity. And as a consequence of that, there are all whenever you give anything those attributes and that kind of power, there are incredible societal consequences or ramifications. And one of those consequences of giving the Bible that kind of power is that we end up playing out what are essentially Iron Age gender roles.
Could you explain a little bit more about that?
Sure. Let me explain first of all about what I mean by turning the Bible into an idol. By the way, there's a term for that. The term is bibliolatry. And it means specifically making an idol out of the Bible within Christianity, but beyond that, it means making an idol out of books, the written text, which is essentially, after all, just a communications technology, and fortunately one that we are evolving beyond. After all, they say that a book is out of date the moment it's in print, and in fact, they're often out of date. Anybody who's in an academic town like this one knows that a book is often out of date before it's in print. but there's that this notion of kind of giving this the Bible or any book that kind of powerful status, and then the other half of that question is about the kinds of gender roles that are in the Bible. Gender in the Bible, regardless of how the more benign variants of Christianity try to describe it, and despite the fact that there actually is an evolution of gender roles within the biblical texts themselves, it is profoundly unequal. In the Old Testament, the relationship between men and women, and I will talk about this more at length tonight during the lecture, is essentially governed not by a rights ethic, but by a property ethic. So when a woman is violated, that is a property violation. Women are in the same category as livestock, slaves, and children. They belong to men, and if a man does something to harm one of those, he is he's doing property damage, and he needs reimbursement for property damage. So that is why in the Bible, for example, a rapist can be obligated to buy the woman he has raped for 50 shekels, and then after that he's obligated to keep her.
And those seem to be extreme examples of gender roles that Abrahamic religions, and we should define that, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, and Baha'i, I believe, have for the most part distanced themselves from, at least even some of the fundamentalists will say, well, you know, sex slavery was common in the Bible, but, you know, few people are accepting that today, right? Not.
We had a whole slate of Republican politicians in the fall who suffered from what has been described as rape Tourette's, meaning they just simply couldn't stop themselves from blurting horrible things about rape. And if you look at the kinds of corners that they back themselves into and the media circus around that, you know, the God intended rape and rape babies are gift babies, that kind of thing, in reality, that kind of thinking derives straight out of the biblical text.
This is the same group of folks that would not renew the Violence Against Women Act. And, of course, since women were property, if I had property and I damage my own property, who's to say anything about it? It was my property. I only hurt myself. Because the women were not... what if you damaged my property? Oh, I'm coming after you.
I was recently writing an article about these guys with rape Tourette's, the title of which is What the Bible Says About Rape and Rape Babies. And as I dug into what the Bible says about rape and rape babies, I realized something that I'd never noticed before, which is that there is nowhere in the Bible, neither the Old Testament nor the New Testament, in which it says or implies that a woman's consent is needed or desired before sex. And in fact, throughout the Bible, there are many kinds of sexual relationships that are either endorsed in the under the Hebrew legal code or are blessed by God that are explicitly non-consensual. And God blesses those non-consensual unions with boy babies, the best thing he can possibly bless them with.
So what is going on with the leadership of fundamentalist Christianity today? Do you see those who have the religious power in this country trying to preserve that sort of system of dominance? You know, we've seen that with a local fundamentalist church here in town that's gotten quite a bit of local power and caused a lot of controversy. You know, the leaders teach that women must submit to their husbands and generally seem to be very fearful of losing the power of their gender. And do you see that going on among the leadership of the fundamentalist community today?
There's a movement within conservative Christianity called complementarianism. It's basically a separate but equal doctrine, treating men and women, you know, God made women just as equal as he made men. It's just that he made them for a different purpose, and their purpose happens to be to stay home and produce babies, sorry, which is, by the way, very biblical. And I could quote chapter and verse to back that up as well, but the church fathers have already done that for me. The complementarian movement is, you know, part of what you see when you look at, when you see those people like the Duggars on television who have a gazillion kids, and they are actually a part of a subset of that movement called the Quiverful Movement, which even in Seattle has pervaded the city. There is a mega church there that basically teaches the purpose of women is to get married young, have babies, and repopulate the city of Seattle with good Christians.
Do you think that would work? I mean, there's a lot of rebelliousness when the, among the children when that happens. You know, the Jack Mormon things that come out, for example.
Well, does it work? Yes and no. It doesn't work. My parents were 3 for 3 in terms of producing fundamentalist children. 3 out of 6, I guess, is what I should say. Mm-hmm. But... you know, if you put out enough kids, and the reality is that even if there is a clear portion of a significant portion of those kids who drift away from the faith, if you can control information flow and you can control the access to social communities around those people, you actually can retain a significant percentage of them on into adulthood. And once they make the transition to adulthood, they are likely to stay.
And thus, the attack on public education, it's much easier to pass on your narrow views if there are no other views about.
So that's right.
Homeschooling and charter schools and that sort of thing. It's
Our sense of reality is socially constructed, and if your whole social context says the Bible is the literally perfect word of God, and the world was created 6,000 years ago, and anybody who doesn't believe this has an agenda and is to be mistrusted, and the reason scientists keep coming to the wrong conclusions is because they're looking to find justification for their godlessness, then it can be really hard to think your way out of that box.
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
I just want to tell our listeners who might have just tuned in, we're talking with Dr. Valerie Tirico, and We've got some questions. You've written about the technological revolution and the internet, I think, in a very recent article, making it difficult for religions to preserve their exclusive access to their worldview among the followers. So, but of course, there was another technological revolution that cut away at religion's view of gender in the 60s, and that was the invention of birth control and the ability of women to control their fertility, starting in the early 60s. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that and what has gone on.
Contraception may well have been the most transformative technology that was invented in the last 100 years. You don't often see it on the lists, but the reality is that men and women's roles, since the time we first began organizing as our societies as a species, has been structured around the fact of women not having control over their fertility. And so the social hierarchies, the things that women kind of traditionally do, the power dynamics, all of that is contingent on women not having control over their fertility. And that, so when women in the 60s got the pill, which is actually 1960s technology, we have much better contraceptive technologies available now, but when that became available, and for the first time women had reliable control over their fertility, that was a radical threat to organizations like the Evangelical, the Southern Baptist Convention, and the Catholic Church. And what we see now is that they are doubling down, and it's become very clear in the war on women that they're not just trying to take down abortion rights. They are really after the whole thing. And that's why they more and more keep trying to make the argument, now that they've gotten a large part of their base riled up about abortion, they are trying to make the argument that every effective contraceptive is an abortifacient, even though we've got lots of scientific data that it's simply not true.
Hey, Elsa. Wow, we have a phone caller. You're tuned to KRFP Moscow, and we're talking with Valerie Tirico. I just want to ask, one of the most common themes in your writings and presentations is the separation of religious dogma, particularly among those who are letting go of fundamentalism, because you are a former fundamentalist. Do you tend to promote questioning and letting go of religion by individuals when you speak or write, or do you see yourself as someone who just mainly supports those who have already let go?
I am a psychologist, and I come out of a background as a psychotherapist. And first and foremost, I see myself as providing resources for people who are emerging from fundamentalism. If you go to my YouTube channel, Trusting Doubts channel, for example, that's primarily what you find there, is a mix of resources for people coming out of fundamentalism, including explanations of the psychology of religious belief and conversion and deconversion. But frankly, the consequences of religious fundamentalism in our society are so pernicious that I have found myself more and more simply speaking out and trying to make people broadly aware of those consequences. For example, you mentioned contraception. In this country, half of the births in this country are unintended pregnancies. For women who are unmarried under the age of 30, that's 70%. And our teen pregnancy rate is the highest in the developed world. In King County, Washington, where I live, almost 400 babies a year are born to girls between the ages of 15 and 17. That's a whole grade school worth of kids every year who come into life with the odds completely stacked against them, because those kids, most of them grow up in poverty. They're at risk of criminal justice problems. They're at risk for lower school achievement. They have more health problems. I could go on. In the developing world, there are 120 to 150 million women who want contraception, who want to be able to control when they bring a child into the world, and who know about modern contraceptives and have no access. And that is a consequence of the behavior of American evangelicals and the Catholic Church, and how they have corrupted and distorted American political priorities and used our political system and our government to distort the priorities of and the power structure around the world.
I'm wondering what you think we as ordinary citizens can do to minimize or eliminate these consequences. What can we do in our everyday lives to help the cause of gender equality?
Well, because contraception itself is so undermining of this whole power dynamic, part of what I've been doing recently is putting a lot of energy into getting the word out about the state-of-the-art contraceptives. I said the pill is 1960s technology. What many people don't know is that on the pill, 1 in 12 women gets pregnant every year. People think that it's much more effective than it is, but the problem is simply, if you think about it from a human factors engineering standpoint, you're fertile for 40 years. You maybe want to get pregnant out of 400 cycles. Maybe you want to get pregnant 2 or 1 or 4 or 0 of those, and the rest of the time as a woman you're trying not to get pregnant. That's an awful lot of room for error. And with contraceptives that you have to remember to use every time, like the condom, the rate is even higher. We now have long-acting contraceptives, what are called LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives, like the implant and the IUD, with an Nexplanon implant. The rate of accidental pregnancy is 1 in 2,500. And with the state-of-the-art hormone IUD, it's around 1 in 700, and then it gets and those contraceptives are good for anywhere from 3 years to 12 years, depending on which method you're using. So they're radical game changers. But again, what you're seeing what's happening in Washington D.C., right? Our government recognizes that. And wants to make them available to women who want them and who want better lives for themselves and their children. And we've got the Catholic Church fighting tooth and nail and the evangelicals riling up people to file lawsuits to block access.
Can we extend that logic and say fundamentalism is a major cause of overpopulation and, by extension, ecological destruction of the planet?
Absolutely, you could say that. Absolutely, you could say that. You could also say it's a major cause of death. I mentioned those 120 million in the developing world who just want to be able to give every good thing to one baby before they have another one, as Melinda Gates put it. Millions of those women will die from pregnancies that they didn't even want. And that is, to my mind, the guilt of those deaths is directly, it's blood on the hands of the Catholic Church.
Do you want to take a music break, or does anybody have a question here?
Back at the beginning, you were talking about the regard with which the Bible is held. Some of these people will treat it like an oracle. Open it up and flip it and see what God has to say to me today. Isn't that crazy? We could do that with a phone book or the New York Times. Mm-hmm. It would make as much sense. All right. Well, here's Tracy Chapman, Heaven's Here on Earth.
Here on earth.
KRFP Moscow, and I'm here with Caitlin Cole of Radio Free Moscow and Fidelin Al Chidester of Radio Free Moscow, and I think Caitlin has a question for Dr. Valerie Tirico.
Yes, I do. Dr. Tirico, I've noticed that in some of the larger religions, fundamentalist religions, the mega churches and the Mormon church, they all have their own 12-step programs for addiction, and a lot of times those addictions are addictions to pornography. So I'm wondering why there is such a problem with pornography in these fundamental churches, and if you think that internet pornography reflects or does it cause gender inequality?
Does pornography reflect or cause gender inequality? Well, so first of all, I would say I don't think that pornography is just a problem in fundamentalist churches. In fact, I don't know the research, so I can't tell you whether it's more of a problem in fundamentalist churches than in society at large. Hypocrisy is more of a problem in fundamentalist churches than in society at large. But I read somewhere that somebody was wanting to compare men who had been exposed to pornography and men who hadn't, and they were trying to find, they actually gave up. They couldn't find an adequate sample set for their research of men who hadn't been exposed to pornography. It's ubiquitous. And I do think I am concerned that it is changing the way, as it has become more accessible to young men, that it does shape people's sexual arousal patterns, and that it is because pornographic sex isn't about intimacy, it isn't tender, it isn't loving, that there are a subset of young men, and maybe a growing subset of young men, who aren't looking for that in sex and haven't had any sort of model of a kind of sexuality that might include real intimacy.
Well, one of the strange things, I play music, so I'm out at, you know, out in the nightlife quite a bit, or used to be a lot more. But one of the things you notice, there'd be a certain group of men, not many individuals necessarily, that would just lurk in the bars waiting to find some woman who had gone too far, you know, with her drinking, and they'd pal up with them and, you know, do whatever. Sometimes they were even insensible. When a friend of mine took a cab ride they had to shovel her into the cab, and this other fellow insisted that he was her friend and lived right down the block, so he'd take the cab ride with. Well, she woke up at 4 in the morning, and this man was in her bed trying to pull her panties off or something, you know. And this is stuff that happens, but those people are out there. And they've been, you know, affected by these scenarios. They're replaying whatever they saw on the porn site.
They're replaying scenarios that they've seen on the porn site. You know, and I think that, unfortunately, I worry even that this whole titillating trend of women, you know, like the 50 Shades of Grey thing, right? Mm-hmm. Do I think it's inherently harmful? Not necessarily, but I absolutely think that it is likely to create situations, to set up situations in which there's ambiguous communications and people make false assumptions about somebody wanting to be pressured or wanting to be coerced even. And I think people are going to get hurt because of the kinds of conversations that we are and are not having about sexual arousal in our society.
Well, the definition of no has become very flexible.
Yeah. I mean, the reality of sexual arousal is that it is addictive, right? Mm-hmm. Anything that is highly pleasurable and acutely pleasurable can become an addiction. And we seek pleasure, and so there's the risk of that being out of balance. And then when we kind of are exposed repeatedly to images in which that is removed from real world relationships, from the complexities, from the interdependency, from the intellectual dimensions of real world relationships, I think what you do get is the dehumanization that puts everybody more at risk of getting hurt, and either because they they're on the receiving end of receiving harm, or because they're on the other side of doing harm.
And, you know, if you're doing harm, you're harming yourself. Yeah.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. It did.
Okay, well, we have two graduates of Wheaton College here. Do you guys want to have a chat about that?
Oh.
Tell people what Wheaton College is.
You're bringing me out of the closet. Wheaton College is a private liberal arts Christian college about 30 miles west of Chicago. Back when I was there, I don't know how it is now, we had something called the Pledge. We weren't allowed to possess playing cards, belong to secret societies, go to movies, dance, drink, and various other things. The only thing they didn't prohibit was sex, because they couldn't bear to use the word.
I always said we weren't allowed to drink, dance, or you know, swear or have sex with anyone who did. Your memory's probably a little better than mine. Of course, the irony of some place like Wheaton, and Wheaton is a flagship evangelical school. People go there to get steeped and stay steeped in evangelical biblical literalism. It is part of what I was talking about earlier in isolating people within a subculture that prevents them from being exposed to the complexities and nuance that exists on the outside and the multiplicity of perspectives. But, of course, at Wheaton, as a consequence of that, there are these falsehoods within Christianity that come bump up against real humanity, right? So part of what that means is that you find kids having sex in the basements of the dormitories, even though there's open door policies on the dorm floors themselves. And part of what we know about kids who don't get real conversations about sex, for example, the kids who are put through abstinence-only sex education and who take those chastity pledges, is that it seems to have surprisingly little effect on actual sexual behavior, but that when they do have sex, they're less likely to have responsible, safe sex.
It's always been a furtive underground thing for them. It hasn't been accepted as a real part of life.
Well, because if you use contraception, then it's not just sex, it's premeditated sex.
Which obviously, you know, on the scale of things, you know, premeditated murder is worse than just regular murder. So.
Yeah.
So Dr. Valerie Tirico is going to speak about the effect of Abrahamic tradition on gender roles. And we mentioned earlier that Abrahamic religions are usually the ones that are, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, and Baha'i, they're mainly characterized by having one singular God. And there are other religions out there. And I was wondering, in your research into fundamentalism and Abrahamic traditions, you've checked in on, not animistic indigenous religions, and how their views of gender roles compare with the religions that are we call Abrahamic.
You know, Lee, I have to say, I am very ignorant about other religions, and in fact, even though the papers you have, so I'm going to talk broadly about the Abrahamic religion tonight, I'm really going to talk about the Bible,
mm-hmm.
So the Hebrew Bible and the Christian New Testament, and that's because I'm speaking to what I know and trying to stay centered on where I can speak with confidence. But let me give you an example of the effect of the kind of ripple down effect within Judaism. I was talking a couple weeks ago with a group in Seattle about this same topic, and afterwards a person who's a retired minister came up to me and he said, you know, I actually lived in Israel for a while. I grew up Jewish and I lived in Israel for a while, and in the Hebrew language, the way a woman says he's my husband is she says he's my owner. So she uses the exact same verb to say he owns me, that as she would use to say he owns that car. And we sometimes don't, there's so many things that we're blind to, right? But they're just, they're embedded in our culture, embedded in our traditions, embedded in our instincts. And unless you hold that up to the light of day and notice it, then there's no way to move beyond it.
It's those basic assumptions that underlie all the structure that goes above it, and all the abusive, discriminatory stuff that's been going on forever, and is hopefully in its last gasp in our era now. We have the unique opportunity to maybe put the stake through the heart of this.
That would be nice. When I think of biblical literalism, what I earlier used the term bibliolatry to describe, I think it anchors people in one place, right? One of the things I want to talk about tonight is that the fact that when our best guesses about the world around us were handed down via oral tradition, as society evolved, as our sense of ourselves deepened and our understanding of the world around us and the complexity and of both technology and society, our spiritual understandings could evolve along with that. In an oral tradition, some stories can be told more often. They can be changed over time gradually. They do change over time gradually. The development of the written word had some really big advantages. It allows you to transmit information to people who have never been in contact with each other. But it also allows some negative things to happen. And one of those is it allows people to become essentially developmentally arrested, right? It's static. It can't change. So you get frozen in time. And then if you think about the Bible, you have these fragments of text that are static, frozen in time, fragments of text. And then you have this process of canonization, which is that process by which authority figures say, this body, this set of texts is perfect and complete and can't be added to or have anything removed from it. And as a consequence, it's like pounding a stake in the ground and staking your whole culture to it and not being able to move forward. So one of the things I love about the internet is that it has the best of oral tradition and the best of written tradition, right? You've got the ability to communicate, to think deeply about something, and to transmit information between people who don't know each other. But it's also fluid. If you go to Wikipedia, it's different every day.
There's no way to do an equal rights amendment and add that to the Bible, you see. We tried to do it with the Constitution, and we better get it done again.
Well, and isn't it interesting that people who have a fundamentalist approach to the Bible often take a fundamentalist approach to the Constitution? That somehow you got a document that's been around long enough, and then somehow it's as if it was written on stone tablets. I wonder where they ever got that idea from.
Holy Moses, what are you talking about?
You're tuned to KRFP Moscow. We're speaking, various KRFP hosts are speaking right now with Dr. Valerie Tirico, the second year of Darwin on the Palouse, the nation's premier international Darwin Day event.
If I could put in a plug for Julia Sweeney's event on Saturday, Letting Go of God is absolutely fabulous. I was laughing so hard I was crying the first time I heard it. I've bought 20 copies of her disc and given them away to friends. It's not only funny, it somehow is tender and smart, and it's funny without being one iota mean, which is really hard to pull off.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, she does come off as somebody who's very empathetic, and you know, you tend to empathize with her when you listen to her.
Okay, this is KRFP in Moscow. We have a little bit of a shout out to some people that help us out here. Here it goes.
It's supported by Buy Local Moscow, representing Moscow's independent business community and helping to strengthen Moscow's economy. On the web at www.buylocalmoscow.com. KRFP thanks all of its donors and underwriters for helping make this programming possible.
Okay, fiddling now. Well, so we're winding down here. I think, do we have anything else to, you know, we have talked quite a bit about how, you know, the fundamentalist leaders are impacting the views of gender roles and trying to preserve the old gender roles. And that's what Valerie's going to speak about. She just took off with a little bit of a coughing fit, but she's back in the room. And is there anything we want to say to sum up about tonight's talk and so forth?
Well, there's one little thing I want to point out. The connection between the gun lobby and the fundamentalist right, the Christian right. There are some churches that are, you know, like, oh, yeah, you can now bring your guns into church. Also, the pink pistols that were recently in the news, they were in the news back over the Susan Komen Foundation thing, and then some child shoots himself with one of these lovely, beautiful pistols.
It doesn't seem like it should line up, does it?
No, it doesn't.
I my best hunch is I have a couple of hunches about that. One is that, well, one hunch is simply that if you look at the Bible, actually it is a profoundly violent text. So even though it teaches kindness and compassion, it is kindness and compassion under very specific circumstances.
Yeah.
And the core mythology is one of profound violence.
Bring me 10,000 foreskins of the Philistines.
Exactly. Exactly. And God can't forgive us without a human sacrifice. So there is that part, and I think that level of redemptive violence, justified violence, righteous violence, gets embedded in people's psyches in ways that have consequences that we probably have no idea how to sort out. The other thing I think that is probably a factor in why fundamentalist religion and the gun, you know, you'll pry my gun out of my cold, dead hands. Mentality goes together is that it's fear-based, right? So that what you see in both of those groups of people, which, as you said, are very largely overlapping, is the sense that the world outside is a scary place, that other people are really bad people, that the forces of anarchy and darkness and chaos are just barely being held at bay. I mean, you have to remember that a lot of fundamentalist Christians truly believe that when they are raptured up to heaven, the world is going to descend in complete anarchy because the rest of us have no basis for morality. We have no moral core.
and the hypocrisy of the supposed moral core that they claim to have is obvious to everyone but they themselves.
Well, I don't know that they're less moral than the rest of us, but it's really obvious to anyone who's looking that children are born with moral emotions, empathy, shame, and guilt, the ability for compassion regardless of what religion they are born into anywhere in the world and or whether they're born into any religion at all, and that the moral reasoning process and the process of moral development occurs in the same stages, again, regardless of which religion children are born into or whether they are born into a secular, wholly secular family. And so what we know is that about religion is that it claims credit for our moral instincts, but it doesn't cause our moral impulses, and it isn't the root of morality. It can shape morality, and I think sometimes it shapes it for the better by emphasizing and inspiring and generating focus on something like compassion. But there are other times when it will take a moral instinct or impulse and exploit it for purposes that have nothing to do with morality.
The basis for war.
Mm-hmm.
I was a conscientious objector back in the day, and in 1970 when I went before my draft board and I told them I wasn't going to kill anyone for any reason. There was happened to be an old lawyer on that draft board. I'd been on a church bowling team with him once, and he says, "Oh, Al's always been a good religious boy," and they give me the deferment. But the thing, you know, the justification for war is just a bogus argument that's been carried on forever. You can use God to justify your crimes.
Well, the Yahweh of the Bible, if you actually dig into the history of those ancient Middle Eastern religions, Yahweh originates as a war god, specifically. And you see that the vestiges of his status as a war god in the Old Testament, where there are clear fragments still of polytheism in both the language that's used in the Old Testament, and what you see is that Yahweh basically he's got his people, and then other gods have their people, and he rewards his people, and he helps them primarily in battle against other tribes. And then over time, the concept of what and who Yahweh is becomes more universalized. But that notion of righteous violence is inextricable. And until people move beyond the idea that the Bible is a perfect moral guide, it's going to continue to sanctify some of our own worst impulses.
That is for sure.
KRFP Moscow. Well, I want to thank Valerie Tirico for being with us this afternoon and talking live on the air. Dr. Valerie Tirico is a psychologist, and she's also the author of Trusting Doubt, a former evangelical looks at old beliefs in a new light. She writes for Huffington Post and Alternatus, by the way.